It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Andrew Neil, and this is The Backstory, a series of in-depth interviews with people who have the power to shape events and to influence our understanding of them. My guest in this episode is a veteran Conservative MP who was first elected in 1987. He's been chairman of the party and after the Brexit referendum became the first Secretary of State for exiting the EU. David Davis is a staunch defender of civil liberties. We talk about that and his views on the Johnson government, Brexit, and the cost of living crisis. We also talk about his call for the Prime Minister to resign over Partygate.
You have sat there too long for all the good you have done. In the name of God, go.
Has his view changed since that moment in the House of Commons in January? And what does he think of the government's approach to the cost of living crisis? This is The Backstory from Tortoise. David Davis, when you were a shadow Home Secretary, you used to talk about bagging a ministerial resignation like big game hunting. You had to kill with the first shot. Did you go too early with your call for Boris Johnson to resign?
No, that was aiming to do something different. I mean, the first thing to remember is that with Conservative leaders, it's always a slow death. The idea that the Conservative Party is a ruthless organisation that sets about dispatching rapidly its failing leaders is just not true. I mean, Theresa May took 2 years to go. John Major never went, you know, even though the challenge and the danger of keeping him was obvious. So it takes a long time. But what was happening back in the beginning of the year was that there were a lot of people sort of hesitating, saying, should I go, should I not? Should I send a letter in, should I not? And I took the view, frankly, that somebody had to say that this needed to happen. Somebody, and up until then, it had been all mostly fairly new junior members of parliament. And I thought somebody with a bit of profile should say it. And it worked. It got round the world, as it were. But it will still, I said at the time, I was interviewed shortly afterwards, just for 5 minutes, and I said, the thing I fear is a death of a thousand cuts, that it spreads gradually to the rest of cabinet and then to rest of government and takes until the autumn to happen. And that, I fear, unfortunately, is all coming true.
So you think it is still death by a thousand cuts and that he will, Mr. Johnson, will be gone by the autumn of this year?
Yes, I do. And the reasons in essence are, the problems keep coming. There's a pipeline of them. There are others to come down the road. There's PPE. There's the investigation in London, which comes back to him, the lady whose name I can't instantly remember. There's the most dangerous one of all, from his point of view, is the Privileges Committee, because if they judge that he has lied to the House deliberately, then that will lead us either he'll resign or there'll be a constitutional crisis. So there's a whole series of things coming. But the thing is, every time you see this, the headlines, there's a flood of letters going in. A flood is 2 to 3 to 4. It's not 20 to 30, you know. And so they'll gradually build up. And the reason I said autumn is because it's the last chance. the party will, lots of members of the party will do sets of calculations. I'm afraid this is terribly cynical, but it's the way it works. They'll do lots of calculations about their own seats, about their prospects of staying in government and keeping a job and all that sort of stuff. And if in the autumn it still looks bleak, and it will, I think, not so much care of Boris as care of other aspects of policy, then they'll realise that's their last chance, because next year he could call an election at short notice.
He does have this ability, though, to defy prediction and to survive. It takes 54 letters from Tory MPs. Mm-hmm. 15% of the parliamentary party have to want him to go to trigger an election on his leadership. Now, the Prime Minister has been fined for breaking the law in Downing Street. Mm-hmm. The Tories are now regularly behind in the polls. Mm-hmm. Labour has not a massive lead, but a reasonably comfortable and consistent lead now.
Yeah.
His own personal ratings have tanked.
Yeah.
The party culture he has presided over in 10 Downing Street has been laid bare in all its gore, mm-hmm. and all its embarrassment by Sue Gray. But he's still there, and he seems to think he's over the worst.
Well, you use the word embarrassment. It's a very important word when it comes to Boris, or rather the absence of it is. I always used to say when I was Public Accounts Committee chairman that the primary weapon of a parliamentarian is embarrassment, the ability to embarrass the government. You can't embarrass Boris. So take a couple of the examples I was citing. When Theresa May didn't lose the leadership vote but came close, she said, "I'll do this and then I'll leave." Yeah. John Major didn't wait for leadership vote. He called one in himself. Mm. You know, there is a certain aspect of character around each of those that doesn't apply to Boris. Boris's basic strategy is not terribly complicated, is sit it out. Wait. People get bored. The subject changes. Mm. I find a better argument. I do something good. I score some hit somewhere. You know, something comes along. Ukraine.
A war in Ukraine.
Yeah. And so that's his. It's always been. It was when he was mayor of London. He had the same sort of thing happen. You know, I told one occasion he came out when he'd had some sort of terrible things in the papers and said to the staff, "Remember, this is just a show, and the show will go on." That's his stance, Philip.
You mentioned the investigation involving Jennifer Arcuri.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Whose name you had a little trouble remembering there, but that's who it is. That happened when he was mayor of London, if anything happened. You think that is still a danger to him?
Oh, yeah, all these things are. I mean, because what we're in, and I'm afraid your listeners will think this is a terribly mechanistic argument, but I'm afraid it's just the truth. What we're in is a sort of micro ratchet. A letter goes in, another letter goes in. Very, very rarely they come out. I mean, very few of the ones who said to come out actually have. A letter goes in, and it's a visible process, and it's a sudden death process. And so, you know, we might be at 53 letters today. I don't think we are, but we might be. In which case, one slip
tilts it,
and so anything could do it. You know, because the other thing I've got to remember is that apart from the calculations that MPs do, and frankly the moral stances that some of them properly take as well, there's also other influences on them, particularly their own associations and so on, and they get tired too. You interviewed me, I think, 2 days before I intervened on Boris.
Actually, it was the day before.
It was the day before. It's quite close time. It's largely your fault, actually, Andrew.
It usually is.
and I thought, well, I'm going to make 1,000 enemies, but so be it, you know. What was astonishing to me is the next day, the Thursday, I'd got on the train, and of course we were wearing masks, and got on the tube wearing masks. When I got to the tube, I normally take my mask off when I get to the ticket barrier, right? I got applauded as I went through the ticket barrier, you know? And people kept coming up to me for the next week and saying, "Well said, Mr. Davis, you spoke for us." And I went to an association dinner in York the next day. And I thought, this is going to be heavy weather. At least half of them are going to be pro-Boris and so on. Turned up, 100 people, 4 pro-Boris, 90-odd the other way, you know. I think this is percolating back. And as I say, it's a sudden death outcome.
But the biggest threat must surely be the Parliamentary Privileges Committee.
That is.
But the bar is quite high. It's not enough that he misled the House.
It's deliberately.
It has to be deliberate.
And this is, this is where people will have to make a judgment. I think had there been, I don't know, four or five fines, there would have been a problem. And I'll come back to why in a second. Or had there been a dozen photos, it would have been a problem. Why do I say that? Because broadly, Boris's line has been, I wasn't told. Well, I wasn't told doesn't hold up if you were actually there. Yeah, I think. And you're holding a glass of wine. I mean, I'm not prudish about having a drink of wine, even at work, frankly, if you're working 24 hours a day. But what I think it does is it points to knowledge. And that's the... It's normally incredibly hard for a privileges committee to find a guilty verdict on deliberate misleading. But I think he's used the thing, I wasn't told so many times. I wasn't informed, as far as I'm aware. That sort of form of words, I think that's where they'll look. And that's where I'd expect them to look.
One of the things, surely, that has kept him in situ is the absence of any obvious successor. Do you see an obvious successor?
Well, that's... Look, I don't comment on the would-be successors, but I will do to this extent. Your question you have to answer there is, would the successors, and there are probably half a dozen prospective, realistic prospective successors, would any of them have done a worse job? You know, I mean, take Ukraine, which has been seen to be his saviour for the moment. Would they have done something different? Well, I don't think so, because actually most of the significance of British involvement was essentially an MOD policy, you know, driven by Ben Wallace,
the Secretary of State for Defence.
That's correct, and I don't think that, let's say, Jeremy Hunt or Rishi Sunak, he's probably struck out now, but he was one of the ones at the time when the argument was being made, or any of them, frankly, would have stopped that happening. Neither would they have... They might not quite have made the public presentation of it that Boris has done, the sort of slightly sort of sub-Churchillian stuff, but I'm not sure that's that important. So the question is, would they... You may not think they're the best people in the world. After all, I mean, you and I were around when Margaret Thatcher took over, and even though I was a supporter, I wasn't 100% sure back then that she'd do a job.
It was a risk.
It was a risk, you know, and these are all risks. And the question you have to ask yourself is, is the probability they do a less good job? I think the answer is not so.
But getting rid of a prime minister, you would want some kind of idea as to where the gene pool is for his successor. And the Tory gene pool seems quite depleted at the moment.
Well, that's partly, I think, a strategy by Boris himself of not having people around him who might be challenges. I mean, Jeremy Hunt's a good case in point. I'm not a Jeremy Hunt advocate, don't get me wrong. But he was
the former health secretary.
He was the former health secretary. He was also the foreign secretary, and he came second in the leadership contest. And that gives you
certain... In the summer of 2019.
It gives you certain, if not rights, expectations. You know? So, for example, when I came second to David Cameron, he said he was ruminating over sending me to defence. I said, I don't want to do that. I said, you know, I'll do... shadow home or nothing. I'll happily go to the back benches, but and of course he gave me shadow home. And that's what you would expect. For Boris to offer Jeremy a demotion, in my view, is improper. You don't ask the person who's given you a run for your money and has come second in the party's batting order to take a step down. So, and this applies across the board. You know, where's Liam Fox? Why is Penny Morton not in? Where's Greg Clark? I mean, there are quite a lot of people around who could well have been in that cabinet who are not there. I very nearly sent him a Christmas present the year of his election victory, of general election victory, which was a book about Lincoln called Team of Rivals.
Yes, which is about the quality of the people around Abraham Lincoln.
All his rivals pulled in and it made a fabulous cabinet, you know. I didn't eventually, because I thought you might think I'm trying to Bully Moy back in, I'd said to him no. So, but nevertheless, I was tempted because that's precisely what I thought he was going to do. And you know what? If he had, I think he'd have less problems. I think you've got to give him his due. He's a good attention holder. He's fabulous at holding people's attention, right? He isn't the best speaker,
no,
actually, but he does make good speeches. He writes good speeches and he delivers them well. You know, he's not fast at the dispatch box, but he's good at holding attention. He's good at getting the identification of the public with him. You know, somebody like that, being the chairman of the board, I think would have been a fabulous position for him. And I think I don't know whether it was his own judgment or other people advising him. Remember, early on, he was being advised by Cummings and that pack, who have no respect for any MPs at all, and as a result would probably say, oh, just keep them out, you know.
I wonder if Boris Johnson isn't emblematic of a wider Conservative malaise. I mean, nobody seems to know what he stands for, but nobody's quite sure anymore what the Tories stand for, do you?
Yeah, well, it's a matter of debate. That's certainly true. part of this is not his fault. You know, when I voted for Boris to be leader, I did not foresee COVID. You know,
no one did.
Yeah, no, but that's quite important because that COVID period sort of blotted out government. It probably shouldn't have, but it did. Yeah. And the result of which is we sort of forgot what our aims were. You know, when you come out of a general election, you've just got your manifesto, got the rubber stamp of the public approval on it, you hope. And so you then set about carrying it out. All they had the bandwidth for, frankly, was picking up pieces on COVID and picking up pieces on Brexit, not even driving Brexit forward. So there was a sort of losing of way, I think. And what this period now we're in right now, between now and Christmas, is about is trying to refine our way. And a lot of my fellow Tories were rather uncomfortable at the end of a perfectly workmanlike Queen's speech, but it wasn't a banner flying Queen's speech. It wasn't a Queen's speech saying, right, we're back on an even keel now, broadly, it's time to get back to being Conservatives. And that's not showing at the moment.
Well, let's come on then to the Chancellor's recent statement dealing with the cost of living crisis, which followed a spring statement that he made. And, of course, the budget's coming up in the autumn. Has the Chancellor done enough or too much?
Not enough broadly, but too much as well. There are sort of two or three different measures here. Measure number one is what's the state of the ordinary family's weekly budget. Yeah. That, in many ways, is the most important thing. The test of a country, the test of a government, sorry, is how well it looks after its people. That's what it's there for. That's why it's a democracy. And that on that, we're not scoring terribly well. Right? The Chancellor, to be fair to him, was given really duff information by both the Treasury and the Bank of England.
On their predictions for
on
the
prediction,
economy.
They're both completely wrong.
You know. On inflation.
On inflation for the bank, but on tax revenue for the Treasury.
Because they underestimated.
90 billion. I mean, that work out what that is. So your listeners think about this in real money, because 90 billion means what? You know,
it's twice the defence budget.
Twice the defence budget, or more pertinent to them, £3,000 per household. We got it wrong. Why, £3,000 a household, right? So they've got tons of money coming in. Now, of course, we're still in negative balance, but we're crawling out of COVID, right? But you don't. If you're going to balance, you know, I am a fiscal conservative. If I'm going to balance the books, I balance it over 5 years or a full cycle, not over the first year out of a crisis. So answer your question. At one level, he was misled in two directions. That meant he's taking too much tax. Should have cancelled NICS, the national insurance increase. Should have cancelled next year's corporation tax increase.
Which is increasing from 19 to 25%.
That's right. And he shouldn't be putting windfall tax on either. The windfall tax, at one level, is trivial. right? It will probably raise 1 billion. He says 5 billion. Listen, I used to be in a big corporation. I was a director of a FTSE 100 company. You know, if I were in their business, I'd be investing like mad, even in negative outcome projects, to save 90% of the money in tax.
Because that's the tax allowance he's
now
allowed.
That's the tax allowance. Basically, for every million you invest, you get 900,000 back. You know, well, you have to be an idiot not to take that right up to the hilt, right? And it means you'll take all the marginal projects, not all of which will work, but you'll get your tax money back. So it's not going to raise that much money, but the symbolism of it is terrible. Not in just in the energy industry, in fact, less in the energy industry, more everywhere else. People look at Britain and we think of ourselves as a stable tax environment. Are we hell? We've had 5 windfall taxes over the course of your my career, basically. You know, 2 in banking and the rest mostly in energy. So you know, I'd look at this and say, my cost of capital's a bit higher there. I'm not quite in it. If I've got a ranking order of investment, Britain's not going to be at the top of it, you know. So it's done harm on quite a big, invisible harm on a big scale. It's not got any money in.
Well, we don't know yet. I mean, it is 25%, which is quite a lot there. And we know the energy companies are awash with money. I mean, the head of BP described his company as a cash machine.
That's Mr. Looney you're talking about.
Yes, and this is called in the business now the Looney Levy. But and so we'll see. I mean, he says 5 billion, we'll see. I think he may actually get a bit more than that. He may get less, as you say. But there was a case for doing it, was there not? Because it isn't going to affect the investment plans.
Well, not the first cycle.
Mrs. Thatcher did it. Gordon Brown did it. Not all in the energy companies, but windfall tax. Gordon Brown did it. We had 10 years of solid economic growth. George Osborne did it as well. It doesn't seem to be the big, one way or the other, it doesn't seem to be such a big deal breaker.
Well, for me, I mean, firstly, even if he gets 5 billion, you know, this is in a 90 billion. Bear in mind, the error margin is 90 billion now, I'm afraid. So it's a long way inside the error margin. It's a third even of his forecast increase in help this time around, at his maximum, you know.
Because he's putting in 21 billion when he gets 5. What you're really saying is that because the Treasury forecasts were wrong, because tax revenues were more buoyant, because he was taking out the furlough money and other pandemic spending, that actually he had enough money to do the package to help families without a windfall tax. That's, I think, what you say.
That's exactly right. He had enough money. I mean, I'll go further than that. He had enough money to cancel NICs, cancel the VAT on fuel, put the 20 quid back into universal credit. And then do something on top of that to actually control the cost, to subsidise the cost. He could have done all of that way inside the margins that he was working to 1 year ago when he set the budget that set all those things. Yeah? So I wouldn't have done it this way. I mean, I'm very old-fashioned. I don't think about Conservative policy. I don't think that a Conservative government should basically take all your money away and hand it back as pocket money. I think you're the best decider on how you spend your money, not the government. And that's true whether you are rich or poor, frankly. So, you know, I think that's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is there is, which we didn't get around to, which is there is a real risk in all this of impinging on growth. And there are two reasons that's a problem. One, it hits his tax revenues for next year. We don't really know where we're going to go. But two, we've got stagflation coming down the line. And if you go into stagflation, low growth, the solutions to stagflation, that is high inflation and low growth together, are incredibly painful. You and I, in our earlier lives, lived through a decade and a half of stagflation. It was a nightmare. So it's really, really, really problematic. And I just don't think the Treasury's got a proper strategy for what's coming.
But was the Chancellor right, just to finish up on this cost of living package, was the Chancellor right to target resources that he had on those who most needed it, you know, these basically what I would call helicopter money. He's sending a check to people rather than what a lot of Tories wanted was, oh, cut tax, you know, take a penny off income tax, take 5% or 5 percentage points off VAT. Mm. Was he right to do it that way? Because these broader tax cut ways would have also resulted in more money for a lot of people who weren't necessarily first in the queue to get more money.
No, they're not. But the simple truth is we are, you know, we collected last year the greatest quantity of tax ever in the history of this country, ever, you know. We are at the top end of the tax burden. We need to bring it down. I would have altered the balance. You're quite right. I'd have altered the balance to give as much back as, well, actually not to take away in the first place, as much as possible from most people.
The national insurance rise was clearly a big mistake, was it not?
Huge mistake, huge mistake.
And it didn't have to be done.
It was completely unnecessary. I mean, to put the numbers in context, we talked about the 90 billion error. The national insurance was about 13, 14 billion.
Correct.
That sort of order of magnitude.
Right. So, per year.
So it's 1/6 of the error. Yeah, and we must expect that error to carry on because, you know, the truth is we're going to grow from a higher base next year. So I would have given more, I would have taken less money in the first place and then done some focus work to make sure they're very poor. But remember I said I would also put back the 20 quid, which they should never have taken out.
For the universal credit.
Exactly, because that's really, really important. And, you know, people, it's food money. It's not just energy. Everything's going up.
10%, and it would be spent.
And it would go back into the economy. And, you know, it doesn't matter whether you have an effective demand, a Keynesian model of growth, or you have a supply side model of growth. You know, both of them will be helped by lower taxes and putting that money back into universal credit.
Okay, well, if the Chancellor's listening, I'm sure he's taking notes.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
You were a leading Brexiteer. Are you disappointed by what Brexit has delivered so far?
Let me put it this way. I mean, three things to say. One, that the roof haven't fallen in. We haven't had the George Osborne disaster.
The punishment budget.
The punishment budget and all that stuff, you know. If anything, slightly better than other people in this game. Number two, we haven't, however, made the rapid progress on regulation that I would have liked in the new industries. I don't care about the rest. In the new industries that we should have done. And thirdly, I'm afraid the very reason I resigned from the cabinet, which all flowed from Northern Ireland, when Theresa May said to the Commission she would accept full alignment between the north of Ireland and the south. She did that without telling me, and that's why I nearly resigned on the spot.
Which meant full alignment with the EU.
Full alignment with the EU, which then gives us either an internal border or a crisis, you know. And that has not yet been resolved.
Which I want to come on.
Yeah.
But people didn't vote for Brexit because the roof wouldn't fall in. What have the benefits of Brexit been?
Well, one of them is just democracy, frankly. I mean, let me
when before I was Brexit Secretary, when we were having the referendum, my wife had a new kitchen installed to punish me for taking all that time off from home. And every time I came back, I met a new bunch of builders, painters, decorators and so on. They all come from West Yorkshire. They all come from the industrial north, all red wall, you might think of, right? And the sorts of comments that came back to me. Comment number one, painter and decorator. You're in or out, Mr. Davis? I'm out. Yeah, me too. Why? Immigration. I thought, oh dear, here we go. You know, I'm going to get a bigoted response. I said, don't you like foreigners? He said, no. He said, if I were a Bulgarian or Pole, I'd be here. He said, I know entirely what they're doing is right for them as family. He said, the only trouble is, Mr. Davis, I haven't had a pay increase in 10 years. And if I didn't employ him, my son wouldn't have a job. Well, we're not in that position anymore. You know, if anything, we've got a labour deficit in the country.
Well, we have 1.3 million vacancies,
which is a
record. Yeah. And non-EU immigration seems to be at record levels.
That's
right. Did you tell the builder that?
Oh, yeah, well, I did. I said, you do understand we'll be opening it up. It won't be for painters and decorators necessarily, but for doctors and people like that.
So overall, has it made any difference to the immigration numbers?
Well, it's,
because it was a numbers concern for a lot of people.
Well, it was. That's my point. It was an effect concern, you know, on his own wages and so on. And you're beginning to see that come through. Now, it means we've got to solve other problems about labour shortages, but at least we got control to
which
do.
Which may mean more immigration.
Yeah, it may do. But, you know, at least we control it and we do it in such a way it doesn't harm our own people. But the second one, let me finish.
I am struggling to hear the benefits so far.
Well, no, that's one. The second one was a comment relating to the punishment budget. And you remember the £4,000 penalty in Warren?
Indeed.
And as I drove in, I got out of my car, this guy who runs his own building firm said, Mr. Davis, can you tell Mr. Osborne from me, £4,000 for my freedom, cheaper the price? You know, and he's talking about our right to make our own decisions. And that's actually important. It's not very visible.
No.
But it's important.
But I'm not quite sure what decisions we're now taking. For example, one vision, it's a shorthand which covers as much as it illuminates. But one vision was called Singapore on Thames.
It was a daft one, but never mind.
but it was a Tory vision. It was we'd go for lower tax, smaller government, fewer regulations, and regulations which were more suited to Britain rather than Europe-wide. But since we left under this Conservative government, we've got higher tax, bigger government, and just as many regulations. So it wasn't Singapore on Thames, was it? It was Paris on Thames.
The reason you see me smiling, I mean, your audience can't see me smiling, is that it's the person who coined Singapore on Thames was Remainer-in-Chief Philip Hammond, of course. And it was why I went to Vienna and say, no, this is not what we mean. We don't mean massively rewriting the regulation of all the conventional industries. It's the new industries that matter. And we have got some move on that. We are moving on that. But that'll take time to deliver. And I make no bones about that, Andrew. It will take time to deliver on the regulatory changes.
Are you disappointed?
No. Let me be accurate. I don't think we have done as good a job as we could have done, but I don't think that Brexit was wrong. I just think it's going to take longer to deliver. And part of that's COVID, and part of that's the deflection of the current government.
Do you miss being in government?
Not really.
Because, you know, you talk fluently and with some passion on these issues of government. But now you're outside, don't you sometimes think, look, I know what to do. I wish I was back in and I could do it.
No, I mean, I'm quirky. Of all your, I don't know how many MPs you ever get in here, but when you get them in, you'll find I'll be an unusual one. And the reason for that is over the course of 30 something years, I have found that you can do, if you are smart about it, you can do as much outside government as in. You know, the extent to which you can varies depends a bit on the majority. Big majority is harder than a small majority. But you can do as much outside as in if you choose to. And also you can pick your own subject. Of course, you know, Brexit Secretary, you got command over. Well, you hope you got command over Brexit. But nothing else, you know, nothing else. Whereas now I'm, you know, it's about the economy 1 week.
You can talk about what you want.
Brexit, and you can influence what you want. Most of my colleagues don't know the machinery of influence. Let me give you one current example. 12 weeks ago, the day after I intervened on Boris, that the very next day on a Thursday, the most important thing I did that week wasn't that. Most important thing that I did that week was to start a debate in the House of Commons about controlling oligarchs.
The Russian oligarchs, above all.
The Russian oligarchs, principally, yes. It was about lawfare and money laundering and cover-ups and all that. And I got 20 people to come and give a very expert debate. Now those people are the core of the new policy. You know, if you know what you're doing, you can do that. You know, you've got to be able to deploy the parliamentary weapons. Truth be told, they're getting weaker over time as governments try deliberately weaken them. But you can do both.
And you can influence the process.
Yeah.
I understand that. But aren't you also almost just by nature one of its rebels? I mean, the Times says you're the most rebellious Tory MP in this parliament.
Well, in this parliament, I'm not surprised.
because you haven't got many competitors. But don't you enjoy that more than the hard grind of government?
No. Actually, rebellion is harder grind than government because, I mean, and opposition. And rebellion is like an internal opposition. Let's be clear about that. It's harder. Opposition and internal rebellion is harder than government. Why? Because you don't have the vast legions of staff. You have to do the work yourself. I think you referred to me removing Home Secretaries. That was like doing a non-stop finals exam because, you know, you're poor. I mean, I know you, of all interviewers, pour through the data. You love reading the background and you love understanding the details. That's what you have to do if you are an opponent of the government in power. So, well, you know, whether it's as rebel or as opposition. So it's harder work in many ways. But the truth is, I like both, actually. The truth is, I love being a minister, but I also love being an MP. You know, I love being a minister in, you know, when I was Europe minister, you know, or a cabinet office minister, you know, or, you know, and I like being Shadow Home Secretary. They're all fun. Look, listen, we are... Parliamentarians are some of the most privileged people in the world. They have huge power if they know how to exercise it. They have huge influence even if they don't exercise power. They have the right to step in and be Robin Hood at a moment's notice for all sorts of people. And, of course, even on an individual level, you can do it too. So, crikey, I mean, there's nothing to complain about. It's a bloody good job.
One thing that you've campaigned for on several fronts, particularly when you're on the back benches, has been civil liberties. Where does that come from? The your concern for civil liberties, your desire to improve them, your sense of when authoritarianism rears its head. Where does that come from?
When I was very young, I was brought up by my grandfather, who's a communist. And although communists aren't necessarily known for civil liberties, some of the causes he espoused were sort of anti-establishment causes and made me think about the importance of curbing the power of the state. Some of it was seeing how the state behaved when I was a member of it. You know, I wasn't always very impressed by the way people misused power.
When you saw it from the inside.
Saw it from the inside. Some of it, I think in many ways, probably the most influential was when I was Public Accounts Committee chairman, which is the best job in the world.
And probably the most powerful of the House of Commons committees.
Yeah, it was in my day, and I assume it still is, but it certainly was in my day. You were as powerful as anybody other than the top four in government. You know, you're more powerful than most cabinet ministers. And of course, again, you can choose your subjects and range anywhere. And you have 700 fantastic civil servants in the National Audit Office. Really, really good people. And you can actually deliver. I mean, when I did it, I made roughly 1,000 recommendations to the government, of which 950 were carried out. Gives you a sort of measure of it. So, but the point about that, my joke about it is when I'm talking to, you know, Tory audiences, I say, you know, for 5 years, I questioned the people who really run the country, the the permanent secretaries, or the Sir Humphrey Applebys, if you like.
Of each government department.
Of each government department in the Yes Minister thing, you know. And I said, the difference between you and me is that after me doing that for 5 years, you think Yes Minister's a comedy. I know it's a training film.
Given your interest and support for civil liberties, when you look at what the government is doing with the online safety bill, which mm-hmm. is currently going through Parliament, or the policing bill,
yeah.
or some various others, do you detect an authoritarian drift to this government? Because given that Boris Johnson's always thought to be a kind of libertarian...
Yeah, which is never true.
But it wasn't true. So do you detect that kind of drift?
It's never true. I mean, the proper test of that is, when did Boris make a sacrifice to protect liberties? You know, that's the test. You know, we'll take on a real battle and make a sacrifice. No, there is an authoritarian drift. I mean, part of it is because of... populism, really, not to put too fine a point on it.
Or playing to the crowd.
Yeah. The Rwanda policy is an example, for example.
Dealing with the illegal migrants.
Yeah, sending illegal migrants or illegal asylum seekers to a country which has got malaria, dengue fever, schistosomiasis, I mean, you know, you name it. if we sent prisoners there, I think we might be in court, you know. So, you know, criminals.
Well, you might be in court anyway.
Yeah, we might be in court anyway. But so you've got all of that sort of stuff. And also, I mean, there's a degree of thoughtlessness again. Let me give you an example. There was a thing called the Overseas Offences Bill. It was trying to do pretty much the same thing as the current legacy legislation last week in Northern Ireland, to protect soldiers from, if you want it in the sort of Boris terms, you know, ambulance chasing lawyers, all of that, right? And the Overseas Offences Bill was because they were worried about people coming from Afghanistan or Iraq and chasing down soldiers and prosecuting them years and years afterwards, right? I said to them, you do this, you're going to be in terrible trouble because, you know, you can't put a statute of limitations on murder or torture, you know, or war crimes or genocide, you know. And they just ignored it, and just until I got George Robertson, ex-head of NATO.
Indeed, former Labour cabinet minister.
In the Lords, and six chiefs of defence staff to sign the equivalent of my amendment in the Lords. And I also got the International Criminal Court to write them and say, by the way, we'll prosecute if you don't. And then they dropped it. So it was just carelessness. It was pig-headedness, frankly. And so you've got a mixture of populism and carelessness which drives this. And it's one of the reasons, much of our discussion today, Andrew, has been about the direction of the Conservative Party. And the reason it's important for parties to have a direction is because it immunises you against this sort of carelessness, you know, this sort of giving in to populism.
Because you have some guidelines.
You've got some guidelines. And what's more, you know, it also immunises you to some extent from a tendency in modern times to think that a focus group or an opinion poll or the opinion of a sort of 27-year-old PPE graduate are somehow better than the wisdom of all the people who went before us.
You were first elected as an MP in 1987. Could you give us a good example of what you believed then, but you don't believe now, where you've, on a major issue, you've changed your mind?
Yeah, I can't.
Really? You're consistent.
I can't.
Either consistently wrong or consistently right.
Yeah, well, exactly,
right.
Consistently wrong, possibly. But, I think civil liberties, well, no, I was a member of Amnesty International.
Way back then?
When I was 18.
Right.
I'll tell you what. Yes, there is one, I think. And not so much changes of direction as belief that things are now possible that they weren't before. The reform of the National Health Service, I think for most of my political career, it's been impossible for the Conservative Party to address it properly, and the Labour Party's never wanted to. And I think in the last few years, the public appetite has changed.
You do?
Yeah.
I thought the pandemic kind of made the NHS untouchable.
The aftermath of the pandemic has made the NHS subject to lots of criticism. You know, I mean, a little village near me had almost had a riot because they couldn't get to see their GP, you know. people are getting more and more people complaining now because they can't get their cancer tests or their cancer treatment and so on. And I think there's a great deal of that. And that is coinciding with a huge change in technology, whether it's gene technology or scanning technology. And I don't think the current NHS is well equipped to cope with that. So I think, you know, I actually think that for the first time in my political career, that issue is capable of redress. Or being addressed properly and fixed. The other difficult, and it will be controversial, and be, you know, we may win and lose elections on it, but that can be done.
I assume that you think your ministerial career is over, but not your backbench career.
My backbench career is certainly not over. I intend to continue unless the good people of East Yorkshire decide I'm no use anymore. The ministerial career, depends who's in power, depends what happens, you know. If we had suddenly had a change of government and the new leader said, we need a chancellor or we need a home secretary or we need a foreign secretary, I could probably do those. But, you know, the truth is, when Boris got in, he and I had a meeting. And he thought it was about. He thought I was going to see him about a court case I was bringing against the government. And I'm afraid I said, no, Boris, you're going to lose the court case. Let's not talk about that. So he threw everybody out the room. And he said, what do you want? I said, what do you mean, what do you want? What do I want? He said, well, if you hadn't have resigned, I wouldn't have resigned. And if we hadn't have resigned, we'd still both be sitting here talking about withdrawal agreement number 14 and a half. I said, yeah, I know that. That's why I resigned, you know, to stop that process. He said, so what do you want? And I said, nothing you can give me, Boris, because, you know, he'd allocated the jobs that might have been interesting. At that time, it turned out I had a personal family issue about a disabled child to sort out. And, you know, I wasn't interested at that point in time. But you never know. You know, you never know. So I don't write it off completely, but I don't lie awake at night or any other time worrying about it, you know, because precisely what I said, you know, you don't need to be in government to make a big difference.
David Davis, thank you.
My pleasure.
Tortoise members and subscribers to Tortoise Plus on Apple Podcasts can hear my reflections on that conversation in a bonus episode called Inside the Interview, which comes out every Friday during this series. You can join our newsroom for £50 a year by going to tortoisemedia.com/Andrew and entering the code AndrewNeil50. That's 50 and all one word. This episode was mixed by Studio Klong with original music by Tom Kinsella. The executive producer of The Backstory is Lewis Vickers. Thanks for listening.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.